You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
LeBron talked about just how difficult this season has been, and he talked about being in the bubble to do so.
Probably been the most challenging thing I've ever done as far as a professional. I would be lying if I sat up here and knew that everything inside the bubble, the toll that it would take on your mind and your body and everything else, because it's been extremely tough. But, I'm here for one reason and one reason only, and that's to compete for a championship. And that was my mindset once I entered the bubble, once I entered the quarantine process the first 2 days. And then right from my first practice, my mindset was to, if I'm going to be here, make the most of it.
Yeah, degree of difficulty is pretty high. It's tough to win a title in any year, but I think this is tougher than the normal year because of what's gone on in the bubble. And you got the Lakers. There's no home court advantage here. And you're playing a Miami Heat team that is not afraid. They don't view themselves as underdogs, and the Lakers would be wise to not view Miami anything less than a quality team that's on equal footing with them. Yeah, McLovin.
Would you view this series much differently if it was a 7-game series going back and forth between Miami and L.A., if you're trying to predict the series?
I think Miami has a better chance in the bubble than they would if they were going back and forth, because I don't think L.A.'s losing games in L.A. I know that the atmosphere would be pretty raucous in Miami with LeBron coming back, but I do think these younger players, they're playing in the NBA Finals. Tyler Hero's 20 playing in the NBA Finals. Duncan Robinson, a couple of years ago, was playing Division III basketball. Eric Spoelstra's been here. Jimmy Butler loves a big moment here. Andre Iguodala's been here. Bam Adebayo is, 22, 23 years of age? They're playing in an NBA Finals. But I think being in the bubble, almost being cordoned off to the rest of the real world, has helped these younger players. And I think they have a better chance if they're going to pull off a surprise, they would do so in the bubble. And usually the NBA pretty much has the stage to itself when it comes to the finals. But this year they have plenty of competition for eyeballs. But the commissioner, Adam Silver, has to be relieved that the Lakers are here, because without LeBron James, it would be easy for the basketball world to get bypassed because there's so much else going on. And we haven't even gotten to the weekend where you have college and the NFL when it comes to football. You have baseball postseason. There's a lot going on. Everybody watches the Super Bowl. It's a standalone. But there's no other sport that has that crossover appeal. LeBron's the one player, and you might say Steph Curry. There might be a couple of players that are crossover appeal to the casual basketball fan or somebody who goes, yeah, I'll watch it. But here's a guy who happens to still be a dominant player at age 35. And the Miami Heat, we'll see if they're good enough to challenge the Lakers. Miami's young, and they're not going to be intimidated. Maybe the series goes 6 or 7 games. I'm rooting for a competitive series. If LeBron wins another title, I'd be happy for him. But if you said Miami was going to win this, I think it'd be a great story. And Miami's probably 1 or 2 years ahead of where they thought they would be. And I was telling the Danettes, I went to Dan Le Batard's wedding. And during cocktail hour at the reception, Pat Riley comes in with his wife, and the Heat had a game that night. So he was coming in. He just wanted to pay tribute to Dan Le Batard, one of his friends. And Riles had one of his championship rings on. One of his championship rings. Now, I say to my wife, she goes, who's that? I said, that's Pat Riley. And I said, but, he probably won't have much of a conversation with me. I don't think he's big on media members. Pat Riley walks over. Hey, Dan, it's my wife. And I said, this is my wife. And then he started talking about, the wedding and the reception. And I said, hey, I got to congratulate you on the roster you built. And he said, we're ahead of schedule. We're ahead of schedule. He goes, I really like what we built here. Really like what we built. So that's a year ago. And here he is now with his team in the NBA final. He couldn't have been more charming. If it was scripted, he looked great. He looked great. Still looked great. But you can't, when somebody talks to you and they gesture, and he's got that huge ring on, it's like he had a lantern on his finger there. It was just sticking up so large. And you can't help but, when you're watching him gesture and I'm watching that ring fling around. Yeah, Paulie.
Were you bummed out because up until that point of the wedding, you were the most famous person in the room?
Yes. And I did say that to Le Batard. I said, look, I'll go, but you got to promise me I'll be the most famous person. You know, and I walked in and there's Pablo Torres, Tony Reale, you know, Pablo Torre. And so that sounds bad. I'm making it seem like I didn't even know Pablo's last name.
But in South Florida, when Pat Riley walks in, it's over, right?
Yeah. Well, any place if Riles walks in. Israel Gutierrez, Bomani Jones. You know, I was thinking, all right, I'm still probably number one on the list here. And then Riles came in, and then I turned to Lebatard, and I said, damn you. No Ricky Williams. Yes,
he Pat Riley's got to have one of the longest stretches between rings, where he had like one in 88, right? Ooh. And then 2006.
Ooh.
That's, you got to think, after not winning for almost two decades, that you don't think you're going to get another one, and then...
Yeah. I apologize, Pablo. I got your name wrong. Yes, McLeod.
Getting a lot of complaint tweets that you didn't give more respect to Stu Gatz as maybe the most popular.
Well, Stu Gatz came late.
What?
Stu Gatz showed up. He had been at a lacrosse game with his daughters. He showed up at the reception with shorts on. He looked like a mess. But that, well, he looked like Stu Gatz, I should say. But yeah, I did take inventory. As we sat down for the wedding, I'm looking around. My wife goes, who are you looking for? I said, I'm looking for somebody who's a bigger name than me. And she goes, oh, that's sad. And I go, I know it is. I know it is. But I told Lebatard I'd go only if I was the biggest name. But when Riles walked in, it's like when Michael Douglas walked into the studio. And then the fact that Michael Douglas was basically channeling Pat Riley when he did Gordon Gekko in Wall Street. And when Riles walks in, it was just different. Yes, McLevin.
And you might have mentioned this, sorry, but isn't he good friends with The Rock, Dan Lebatard? I thought they were really tight. He was in Ballers and...
He might be, but he wasn't there.
That would have been tough.
That would have been tough, too. I could not compete with The Rock. But, yeah, I was just taking inventory there the whole time during the reception. Because I thought, you know, somebody's going to come in with a cameo and, you know, knock Riley right off the pedestal there. But, you know, John Skipper, the former ESPN president, was there. But, yeah, Sarah Spain was there. You know, basically had around the horn and highly questionable was there. Lebatard's father, Poppy, was there as well. Yes, McLovin.
When you were covering Pat Riley through the years, like, were you ever intimidated by him? He always looked intimidating to me.
This is what happened. So I was covering the Knicks when they were in the finals. And I remember I was with Dr. Jack Ramsey. He was our analyst on the mothership. And I knew Riles could be really tough with the media. And I said, Coach, give me something that I can bring up to Pat Riley that he can't dismiss. And so Jack said, ask Pat about this. And it was something that's really complex. And in retrospect, I shouldn't have gone so deep with him, because he was not in the mood really to answer anything. In fact, Riley kicked me, obviously, out of practice. We were getting ready to do a SportsCenter stand-up, like previewing the NBA Finals or the next game. Jeff Van Gundy was an assistant coach. Van Gundy walks over, and we knew. He goes, and Jack goes, you want us to leave, Jeff? And then he goes, well, Coach wants you to leave. And I thought, you're kicking Jack Ramsey out of the practice? But Riles did. And then we had to go into the bowels of Madison Square Garden there. And you know, and here's Jack, a Hall of Fame coach, wonderful man. And he said, you know, because I was a little upset. I'm like, you know, people want to know what's going on in the practice. And you can say some of this stuff on sports. And he goes, Dan, don't worry. I'll find out. You know, like, he was okay with it. But I always felt bad that, you know, I got kicked out of practice. But I understood that. But Dr. Jack Ramsey was like, yeah. He was okay with it. I don't know how we got here, but we got here. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So what other poll questions are we looking at?
Okay. I don't know if it's fair to ask this in a poll because there's no easy answer. Do you think that the Titans and Steelers will play on Sunday?
Well, we're going to find out with Florio of what is the scenario. I was told yesterday in the evening that they're going to do their best to get this game in. And that could be a Monday night game. They've even talked about a Tuesday night game as well to get this game in. You also have the Vikings. I don't think they have any positives yet, but they play the Texans. Can they get that game in? And keep in mind, when we went back to the NFL season was going to start, and the information I had was they're building in a couple of extra weeks. And I was told yesterday, the NFL's not surprised that this happened. They expected this to happen. But they're trying to figure out, you know, how big does this get? And is this just a speed bump? You know, when you had the Cardinals and the Marlins, when they tested positive, and that was sort of the warning sign for everybody. That's when the siren went off. You know, that's your wake-up call that said, hey, this can happen, and it shuts everything down. And so the NFL was not surprised that this happened. You know, now this is where they go into, can we have the Titans not practice until Saturday? They can't even go to the facility. And then you turn around and you're going to play a game against the Steelers. Can you play Sunday? Can you play Monday? Can you have a standalone on Tuesday? But the NFL was not surprised that this happened. Now, I said, if you go back to when we started the season, here was what I was told, that the NFL was concerned that teams by week 8 are going to be too casual. And, you know, they're not in a bubble. And the Raiders just had a fundraiser where their players showed up without masks on in Las Vegas, and they got caught. And this is an organization that John Gruden, who showed up wearing what looked like a thong on his face the other night.
It's Vegas.
Yeah. And he got fined $100,000, and the organization got fined $250,000 for not heeding the warnings here. Now what happens? They're going to get hit again with another fine. And the first 3 weeks went too smoothly. Now is where you got to make sure that these players understand you cannot be casual with this, because you'll bring down a team. You could bring down a portion of the season. And this isn't like baseball where, hey, Cardinals aren't going to play 60 games like everybody else. The NFL does not want to get into that scenario here. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 to noon Eastern, or 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Dan Patrick Show at foxsportsradio.com, or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR. Or stream us live on the Peacock app. I was told yesterday, keep an eye out for the story, the following story. Do the Falcons try to trade Matt Ryan now and tank for Tua? And I went, okay, who are you trading him to? And does that make sense with the Atlanta Falcons? Falcons, by the way, got a game against Green Bay coming up this weekend. Let's bring in Mike Florio, Pro Football Talk co-host, Pro Football Talk Live. What do you think about that, Mike?
Well, you can't throw me for a loop like that unprepared, Dan. I'm glad I was sitting down. Here's the first thing to look at, and I was trying to pull it up to see what the details would be. What are the cap consequences of moving Matt Ryan? What are the cash consequences? Remember, next year, because of the pandemic, we're likely to have a salary cap as low as $175 million. He's getting $30 million a year. Depending upon where he is in the life cycle of his contract, it may or may not make sense to do something now, to do something after the season, whatever the case may be. But you're right. Who's going to take on Matt Ryan right now during the season? Who would take him on after the season? After the season, you got a better shot of trading him, because that's when teams are trying to figure out what the hell they're going to do with their quarterback position.
Yeah, but you want to tank now so you get Trevor.
They're doing a good job of tanking with Matt Ryan, though. They don't need to trade him, Dan. And here's the thing. The backup is Matt Schaub. So it would be easier to accomplish the mission of getting to the top of the draft board. But, you know, you make a great point. Once you know it's over, once you know it's done, there's no reason to try to win. Put in your backups, evaluate your young players, and hope for the best as it relates to trying to get the best quarterback coming out of the draft.
All right, let's look at the headline here with the Titans and how these positives shutting down the facility affects their game with the Steelers. Give me best case, worst case scenario of trying to get this game in.
Well, best case scenario is they play it as scheduled. The problem is that's not ideal for the Titans because their facility is shut until Saturday. Good luck getting ready to play any team, especially the Steelers, without having the opportunity to practice. And, you know, the questions come up, should the Steelers have to shut their facility too so there's competitive balance? And this is a very simple proposition for me, Dan. it's the ultimate pass-fail test of keeping the virus out of your building. If you don't keep the virus out of your building, you suffer the consequence, even though there may be no one to blame. The reality is the protocols have been put in place, and if they're followed, the virus is out of the building. If they're not followed, it gets in the building and it potentially spreads. So if the end result is the Titans can't practice at all this week, well, so be it. Now, there are other things they could do. They could move the Steelers-Titans game to week 7. That's when Tennessee has their bye. Move Steelers-Ravens from week 7 to week 8 when the Steelers and Ravens have their bye. But the impact on the Steelers would be the players never get a week off. They spend all week preparing for the Titans. And then, oh, that game's moved to week 7, and your week 7 game is moved to when you were going to have your bye. So enjoy your season. You're working every week for 17 weeks.
But can you have this game on Monday night? Can you buy yourself some time? Could you do a standalone game on Tuesday night?
We've seen a standalone game on Tuesday night when the Vikings and the Eagles got bumped back 2 days because of a blizzard. And it gives you a short week on the back end. That's part of the problem. Monday night, we've seen two Monday night games in the past. It's often from the World Series when teams used to share stadiums. There would be a conflict. There have been wildfires that have pushed games to a Monday night. Hurricanes have moved games around on the schedule. So I think all options are on the table. The first question, though, is, what will the test results be today from the tests that were collected yesterday? Will the Vikings have any positives? They've had none. That's good news. How widespread will the outbreak be within the Titans organization? That's really going to be the key, Dan. It's unfortunate that they're shut down until Saturday. I don't know. Maybe if they find out between today and tomorrow that the spread hasn't happened, they can maybe get back in a little early. Playing on Monday, though, would at least give the Titans a shred of an opportunity to have practices, walkthroughs, whatever, to try to put in a game plan, to try to get ready for the Steelers, because it really is a tall task to play a team without practicing at all. But, you know, this is part of the reality of pro football in a pandemic. The commissioner said a few weeks ago there's no competitive disadvantage to teams playing without fans. I mean, maybe what he should have said is, you ain't seen nothing yet. Because once we get into these real-world examples, there's going to be all sorts of unfair things that happen. We just got to get these games played.
Yeah, and I was told last night by a source, the NFL is not surprised that this happened. I think they're surprised it happened this early in the season. Because there was this thought, or is this thought, teams are going to get a little more careless because they're not in a bubble. And you're going to have guys being guys, and they're not going to look at what happened with the Raiders, Mike. How much trouble are the Raiders in if it's true that they had this fundraiser? Players are there. Nobody has masks on. They've already been fined, what, $250,000 as an organization, and Gruden got fined $100,000.
Yeah, and they're also being investigated for having someone in the locker room who wasn't supposed to be there. So this one was stunning to me. And there's a general concern that once teams fall out of contention, players will become complacent. And there's been a concern throughout the training camp and regular season that young players will be irresponsible. What stuns me about the Raiders is that it's their quarterback who was there. Yeah. Derek Carr goes to this thing. Darren Waller apparently was having an event for his foundation. At some point in that conversation, Derek Carr has to say to Darren Waller, dude, we can't do this. You understand what's going on in the world right now. I mean, I appreciate you having a charity and trying to raise money for it. I can't show up at this. You can't show up at this. We can't go to this. If the guy in the locker room who is supposed to be responsible for making sure all players do what they're supposed to do, if he can't be trusted, then that's a major problem. And Dan, Sims and I argued about this earlier today because Sims played for Gruden in Tampa Bay. My argument is it's a bad reflection on John Gruden, that you better have the relationship with your quarterback, that he's not going to do something stupid like this. I mean, they live next door to each other. If you have any concern that your quarterback is going to do something stupid, then you are babysitting that guy. You are with him all the time. You are making sure every day you know what his itinerary is for the night. Hey, Derek, what are you doing when you go home tonight? What are you doing? I'll come over and watch the Monday night game with you. You're not going anywhere. I mean, what in the hell are they thinking? You know, we've complained about quarterbacks in the past who go out and do things during the week when they should be getting ready for their games. There's all the more reason to stay home in a pandemic. It's astounding to me that Derek Carr was there. And I think part of the responsibility goes to John Gruden for not making sure that his quarterback isn't doing stupid things.
Wait, Derek Carr lives next door to John Gruden in Vegas?
That was the story a year or so ago, that he was building a house right next door to John Gruden. I don't know that I'd want to live right next door to John Gruden. But especially now. I definitely don't want to live next to him today.
Give me an update on Antonio Brown. It feels like there are teams that are just sort of waiting in this waiting game, and it feels like you're going to be waiting a while. Is he eligible to play?
He's eligible to be signed by a team right now. He has to miss 8 games. Now, if he's unsigned, he misses 8 weeks. If you're with a team that has a bye in the first 8 weeks, you miss 9 weeks because you have to miss 8 games. We're halfway through that suspension. Maybe somebody signs him on the tail end of it just to get dibs if there's a sense there's going to be a land rush for Antonio Brown, but I think somebody already would have. I think the reality is this. Once he serves the 8 weeks, that's when we see whether or not someone will sign him. And remember, there's still an open question. The NFL hasn't closed the book on the thing he first got in trouble for last year when he was sued in Florida for sexual assault and rape. The NFL hasn't done anything about that yet, but they have left the door open. That is still pending. I think the NFL wants to see how that lawsuit plays out. And if there's a finding in that lawsuit that Antonio Brown did something he shouldn't have done, then they'll revisit it. So he's not completely off the hook once he serves the 8 weeks. And then there's the question of what kind of shape is he in? Is he going to be disruptive to the locker room? Can you trust this guy? All the stuff that came up last year during his time with the Raiders and his short time with the Patriots. But, you know, he's still a very good player. And at some point, there's going to be a contender that's going to need a receiver. And that may be when his phone rings.
This from the NFL Network I just got from Tom Pelissero. One more Titans player learned early this morning he tested positive in Tuesday's round of COVID-19 testing. Sources say all the other tests in Tennessee, all the tests for the Vikings came back negative this morning. So yeah,
that's good news. Now, the best news is zero, but only one more is encouraging. They have to engage in the contact tracing. They have to be sure that anyone who was in contact with that individual who tested positive now, because it can take a little time. You've got that incubation period, and there's a chance it's just a chain of dominoes where it's another guy positive tomorrow. And that's why they shut it down. You want to end it so the incubation period runs its course and you don't have this constant handing of the baton, the COVID baton, from one player to the next. So it's encouraging. Hopefully they get the games in, Dan. And, you know, if nothing else, between what happened with the Titans and what happened with the Raiders, that's a wake-up call to everybody involved, to the players, to the coaches, to the front offices, to ownership, to the league office, that you got lucky through the first 3 weeks. And it's going to take a hell of a lot more than luck to get through the next 14.
Is Earl Thomas going to play in the NFL this year?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, look, Dan, people think he's a top 10 safety. If he was a top 10 safety, he would have been signed quickly. Look how quickly Leonard Fournette was gobbled up by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers when he was cut by the Jacksonville Jaguars. So there was something that happened in Houston, and he went for a workout, and there was a report that they decided it wasn't a fit. And then there was a report that the league said you can't have any workouts or visits. I'm told there's been no blanket mandate that you can't have workouts or visits because of what's happening in Tennessee. So I don't know. I mean, the bottom line is he wasn't very good last year and he was disruptive with the Ravens. They cut him for a reason. And before I would ever offer him a contract, I would want to know everything that went down in Baltimore. And I would want to know everything that went down in Seattle because it wasn't a happy separation when it finally ended for him there.
Before I let you go, Patrick Mahomes was counting 1, 2, 3, 4 during the game against the Ravens. Now, I thought he's counting his touchdown passes. And then I come to find out that he was ranked 4th in, best players in the NFL? Like, help me with this, because these stupid lists, I don't follow them.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if he's referencing that he's the 4th best player in the NFL. Is that why he was doing 1, 2, 3, 4?
Well, he said he had 4 touchdown passes at that time. But last December, when the Chiefs were playing the Bears on Sunday Night Football, at one point he came off the field and he counted to 10. And he didn't have 10 touchdown passes that night. That was the slap at the fact that Mitchell Trubisky was the 2nd pick in the 2017 draft. The team they were playing that night, the Bears, and Mahomes was number 10 that year. So what happened the other night, playing Lamar Jackson, who was number 1 in the NFL's top 100 list coming out of the 2019 season, Patrick Mahomes was number 4. And here's why that happened, Dan. They have the players vote on this top 100 list in November-ish of every season. Last November, Lamar Jackson was the guy. Patrick Mahomes missed time with a knee injury. He wasn't in the MVP conversation last year. It was Lamar Jackson and Russell Wilson. And guess who was number 1 and number 2? Lamar Jackson and Russell Wilson. So when you understand the context, it makes sense. But still, look, when you're at the top of the mountain,
you need any motivation you can find. This was a gift. When I wrote about it when it happened, because he tweeted something about it. He knew what went on when he was number four. When you get that motivation from some phony made up list, good. Because when you're the defending Super Bowl champion, everybody's coming for you. You need something that gets you to go after everyone else.
But we see these great players. Jordan manufactured things that didn't really happen to motivate him. Aaron Rodgers supposedly now motivated because Jordan Love is in town. Tom Brady wants to prove that he's the star, not Bill Belichick. Like, these are the great players. Kobe right. would do this. I mean,
that's how you maintain your edge. That's what gets your ass out of bed on a, you know, at 5 a.m. when you would rather not go do all the things you need to do to put yourself in position to be competitive. I love this because it shows these guys are human. They will tell you, we don't listen to outside noise, right? We don't listen to anything. It was funny. Last week, Drew Brees talking about all the criticism. You know, of course, he's never going to say he listens to it. But he mentions, well, one of the talking points is yards per attempt. Wait a minute, you don't listen to that stuff. How do you know what the talking points are? They always listen. They're extra sensitive. They're extra driven. And it's great because it shows that, like the rest of us, they are fundamentally human and they are driven by the same petty crap that drives everybody else.
Are you off the Ravens bandwagon?
I'm going to wait and see what happens now. Let's see how they react to this, because John Harbaugh told me after they beat the Browns week one, I said, what are you doing to get your guys to forget about last year? Because that's the Bill Belichick play. What happened last year doesn't matter. Harbaugh said, actually, they're embracing last year. They're trying to live up to last year's standard and exceed it. Well, that's fine when you're 2-0 and you're rolling over teams. But then when you get hit in the mouth by the Chiefs and you get humbled by the Chiefs, how are you living up to last year's standard? Are you any better? And when Lamar Jackson says the Chiefs are our kryptonite, I mean, I'm no expert on Superman, but I don't think Superman ever figured out how to beat kryptonite. That's permanent. So I
was shocked with that, Mike. I was shocked that Lamar Jackson let me into his little world and verbalized that. I mean, you just never, ever say that. You can't.
Yeah, and I don't, I mean, at some point you've got, you know, is it Michael Jordan and the Bulls finally getting past the Pistons before they can establish dominance at the NBA level? I look at it this way. When you watch the Chiefs, no matter what's going on, there is a calm. It's almost arrogant how their attitude is, we got this. When the Ravens are down 14 points and they're trying to drive to cut it back to 7, after they cut it to 7 and Patrick Mahomes is like, fine, we got this, right? We're back up by 14 again. Lamar Jackson was visibly frustrated. He was rattled. And I don't know what you do to get past that other than beating the Chiefs. But the reality is they're not going to get that chance until the postseason. And if it doesn't come then, they got to wait until next year to try to show that they have come up with a solution for kryptonite.
Thank you, Mike. Great to talk to you. That's Mike Florio, co-host of Pro Football Talk Live. It's like when Pedro Martinez said that the Yankees were his daddy. And I went, why would you say that? Who's your daddy? Yeah, I just found that. I love when you let me into your world. There is no way, unless I'm wrong, that Jordan said, hey, you know what? The Pistons are our kryptonite. We'll never get by the Pistons. You can't say that. Even if you think it, you can't say that. Because if I'm a teammate, if I'm Lamar Jackson's teammate, I'm going, dude, you got to have confidence, man. They're not our kryptonite. They beat us. We get them again in the playoffs. Like you, because I think, you know, these players look to the leader and go, wait, he feels like that's our kryptonite? You know, it's a game in September. Hey, you know what? It's a long season. We look forward to meeting them in the playoffs. I mean, but you say that they're your kryptonite. I loved it, gave me content, but if I'm his teammate or his coach, I'm like, hey, keep those private thoughts private.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Dan Patrick Show weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Jovan Buha writes, he covers the Clippers for The Athletic, and he had a great column. An inside look at the Clippers and Doc Rivers' decision to part ways after another collapse. And Jovan joins us now this morning. Thanks for joining us on short notice. I appreciate all the legwork you did in that column. Let us behind the curtain here of what exactly was happening during the regular season that led to this point that Doc and the Clippers part ways.
Well, Dan, the way it was described to me was just a accumulation of philosophical differences between Doc Rivers and the Clippers organization. And, you know, I do think the 3-1 series, you know, blown series lead was kind of the final straw, but it wasn't just that. You know, I think looking at his totality of his work in L.A., I don't think that success that he had in Boston ever fully translated. You know, it translated in the regular season, but if you looked at the Clippers' playoff resume under Doc Rivers, they were kind of always at or below expectations in the postseason. And I think that, you know, that combined with when he met with Steve Ballmer and you know, had phone conversations with him several times after the loss, you know, when they were discussing the future of this team and what the roster would look like and what their style of play would look like, they just were on two completely different pages. And, you know, I think it's one thing for the performance to not necessarily always be there or be up to expectations, but when you're trying to diagnose what's wrong and how do we fix this and you two can't come to an agreement, I think that's where you see what ended up happening on Monday, where they just agreed to mutually part ways. Because, you know, this was something that I think had been building over years and even, you know, recent weeks. And you know, in my story, I outlined a couple of examples of things they didn't see eye to eye on. But this was not some just overreaction to him losing the Denver series. I think this was something that had been in play for a bit.
Yeah, I was wondering about substitutions that he did and did not make. I was also wondering, and this was not a well-kept secret, that you had some of the players on the Clippers, and you pointed this out in your column, who didn't like the preferential treatment that Kawhi and Paul George were getting here. It felt like everybody was all in on the Clippers. Vegas had them as the favorites here. Like it was, I guess now looking at it, it was obvious that there were some issues there behind the scenes. I'm hearing they didn't have leadership on this team. Like, you know, it's just such a strange concoction here where you go, okay, they want to play for Doc. You got two marquee guys. You got Kawhi, who's on the verge of moving into that top 10 all time. They got good role players, sixth man of the year. They got everything they need except for they don't have really anything there. How did this go wrong so quickly, though?
So I actually outlined this, some of this stuff in a piece I reported back in January on some of their chemistry issues. And this stuff just never fully went away. And you know, I had an anecdote of a substitution in Philadelphia back in February, where Doc is subbing out Kawhi Leonard, and you know Kawhi says something to him, throws his arms up, and Doc retracts that decision and ends up pulling Lou Williams, and you see Lou Williams' reaction, and Lou Williams gets upset, and he just kind of you know throws his arms up at Doc and kind of walks like a sad kid going in the corner, you know, on timeout. So it was just those dynamics were at play, and I think the biggest mistake that ended up happening for the Clippers, you know, that we can see it in retrospect, was that this team, I think they misestimated how that process was going to go with integrating last season's team with two new stars. And even if you look at other teams like, you know, the Lakers, for example, they still had LeBron James, you know, last season. They still had some of those key pieces, you know, last season, season before. So I think with the Clippers, integrating two stars into that locker room, especially when, you know, we know Kawhi Leonard is not the most extroverted guy. He's not necessarily going to be the leader, the vocal leader in that locker room. Paul George isn't going to be that either. And I think you did have some guys like Pat Beverly, Lou Williams, who were more vocal, but it's a weird dynamic when they're not the best players on the team. And traditionally, you know, the best players are the vocal leaders. And I think they just had this void of leadership this season. And Doc actually was that leader for a lot of time. You know, Doc is a player's coach. He is someone that is well-respected around the league. I mean, we saw what he did in Orlando, but I don't, you know, it can't always be the coach. And I think there were difficult conversations this team need to have at times, and they just didn't do it. So I do think, you know, they almost were successful in spite of that instead of because of that.
If not Ty Lue as his successor, then who?
So I was surprised to hear that they're actually going to be looking at a bunch of first-year head coaches, you know, a bunch of assistants around the league looking for their own version of a Ty Lue, of a Steve Kerr, of a Nick Nurse. You know, looking at what they probably need, I suspected it would have to be a big name, someone who could manage that locker room, someone who could manage all the personalities and egos, someone who could enter a win now situation and deliver a championship basically in year one. I mean, they're kind of in that finals or bust situation now next season. But I was told from people, you know, within the organization that they're going to look for those types of people, but they're also going to look for first year, you know, assistants. And is there a gem somewhere in the league that they can uncover that will be kind of the key to unlock all of this? So they are going to canvass the league and look for that. You know, maybe there's someone out there. Maybe it is just Ty Lue. I was also told he definitely is a strong candidate. So I think for now he's probably the favorite, but he does have other offers.
Could Kawhi and Paul George have saved Doc Rivers if they said to Steve Ballmer, look, if we're not going to re-sign here? Wasn't that part of the reason why they went there, was because of Doc Rivers?
Yeah, that was. And that's also what I wrote, that if they end up winning a championship, with Kawhi Leonard, that might be Doc's greatest achievement, for the Clippers, because he was a big part in recruiting Kawhi, and he was a big part in them executing the Paul George trade, because there was internally some conflict over, are we giving up too much for Paul George? You know, could we still get Kawhi potentially without getting Paul George, or is there another star we can get maybe at a cheaper price? But Paul George was one of the guys Kawhi wanted, and they ended up executing that trade. And I do think, obviously, if Kawhi said, I'm leaving in a year, if you let Doc go, they would have kept Doc. But, so I don't think he necessarily called for him to be fired. I would assume that he just didn't stop it, but as I laid out in the story, I do think there was an element of like Doc had lost the locker room a little bit and not everyone was on the same page with what he wanted or what he saw.
And I said during the Dallas series that, everybody focuses on the Lakers. I said, we should be focusing on the Clippers because they can lose this series against Dallas. And if everybody stays healthy, then maybe they're stretched to seven and maybe they lose that series. I said, there's something going on here. The Clippers felt like they were entitled and there was only one guy with a title who was playing, and that's Kawhi. They came in with the swag that, hey, we're great. And I kept thinking, you guys can't just flip a switch. It's not going to work that way. And that's how it played out. But if the Lakers had been playing the Mavs, we would have been saying, uh-oh, the Lakers can lose to the Mavericks. But because it's the Clippers and, LeBron's not involved in the conversation, I think people, they kind of look past what the Clippers were not doing on the floor. Like, it, to me, was alarming. I think they finally caught up to it when they go, wait a minute, they just lost. They were up 3-1. So I'm not surprised at it. There's still the element of shock, though, that Doc got fired. But he'll bounce back. But I think going forward, like Playoff P should understand when he said, hey, I didn't know it was, win a championship or bust. He should know just how important this season was because his coach got fired.
Yeah. And there was that element internally of they were embarrassed by the Dallas series. They were not pleased by that. For some, they felt that was just as bad as the Denver series. I mean, obviously they didn't lose the series, but they were like, Luka sprained his ankle in game 3. Kristaps Porzingis was out from game 4 through game 6. And we still got pushed to 6 with these guys. And they're like, what if they were healthy? What if both guys were healthy? Maybe we lose this series or at least go 7. So I think, anytime there's these disagreements, there's going to be a fall person. It seems like Doc has been one of them. Paul George has kind of been one of them with some of the reporting that's come out with him. But I do think that this had been accumulating throughout the season. And clearly with the way you don't lose a 3-1 lead the way they did, being up in all 3 games, having double digit leads, being in the driver's seat, relatively speaking, in all 3 games and losing that way, if you're on the same page. So to me, as someone who covered the team all season, they were clearly not on the same page. And to your point, they always existed more in potential, more in theory than in actuality. And that's what we ended up seeing in the postseason.
And they've given up everything with draft picks. I mean, they paid a price, paid a big price here. You did a great job there. And we appreciate you joining us. And good luck with everything with The Athletic there, Jovan.
Thank you, Dan.
Jovan Buha, he's a writer for The Athletic covering the Clippers. Thanks for listening to the Dan Patrick Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday morning, 9 until noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. And you can find us on the iHeartRadio app at FSR or stream us live on the Peacock app. I was diving into this book yesterday. New York Times bestselling author Jeff Perlman joining us. Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the crazy years of the Laker dynasty. And Jeff depicts what transpired between 1996 and 2004. Kobe and Shaq combined, collided, and helped bring the Lakers to three championships, restoring the franchise as a powerhouse. And Jeff joining us now. When did you start to approach this project?
About 3 years ago, probably. I had finished a USFL book and I was looking for a next sort of project, and I live in Southern California. And I just thought, it's not that often you get three iconic characters in one subject. So when you have Kobe, Shaq, and Phil, it just struck me as a really sort of good subject to tackle.
Biggest hurdle in trying to tackle this?
I mean, Kobe wouldn't talk. So when, obviously Kobe was alive when I was working on the book, and he was sort of, you know, the period includes Eagle Colorado, obviously, which is a pretty touchy subject. And I was told early on, your odds of getting Kobe Bryant to talk are not great. And that was correct. So that was probably the biggest hurdle.
And tell me the number. I think it was close to 300 people you interviewed for this book.
It's about 300, 306, I think, maybe. Yeah.
Best interview you had out of the 300?
Oh, well, there were two. Phil Jackson gave me, Jeannie Buss arranged the interview. And I thought I was getting an hour. And when I flew out to Montana to meet him, he greeted me and he said, I said, thanks, coach, for doing this. And he said, I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for Gene. I thought, uh-oh, this isn't going to go well. And then he goes, let's drive around the lake. So it was a 3-hour drive around, I think, Flathead Lake, it's called. Then we stopped for lunch. Then he's like, you want to go back to my house? We can go back to my house. Go back to his house. We're sitting on the porch. At one point, we're sitting on the porch on rocking chairs, and his chair goes over a cat, and the cat just goes, like, scampers all over. And then he's like, yeah, I'm going to take a nap. So you want to get dinner later? I was like, yeah, great. I basically won the 8-hour, like, spend your day with Phil Jackson in Montana tour, you know, raffle prize. It was great. And then J.R. Ryder was on the 2000-2001 Lakers. Remember J.R.?
Yeah, yeah. Isaiah. Yeah.
And I didn't have a phone number for him, so I only had an address. And I was going to be in Arizona. So I figured I would drive. I have a decent track record of knocking on doors. So I drove out to J.R. Ryder's house. And it was one of my most memorable moments of my career. I knock on the door, and a kid answers. And I'm like, hey, I'm looking for J.R. Ryder. He's like, hold on. A woman comes to the door. Hey, I'm looking for J.R. Ryder. My name's Jeff Perlman, reporter. Hold on. The door closes, and I hear two people yelling in the background. Like, who is this? J.R. Ryder comes to the door. He goes, who the F are you? Hey, my name's Jeff Perlman. I'm a writer. He goes, no, man. No, you just show up. Bro, that's not bro. I don't think so. Man, bro, no. Then he opens the door and comes out, and he's like, bro, I'm saying, man, that is not cool. You do not just ride up in someone's house. What's this book you're working on? It's about the Lakers. He's like, all right, I'll talk to you.
Wow. You really had to work him there to get him to open
up. My charm and good looks. It won him over.
How was Shaq?
Shaq was great. I got an hour and about 20 minutes with Shaq in Atlanta. He was fantastic. Couldn't have been better. And I'll tell you a quick Shaq story that I just loved is I was interviewing him. And in the middle of the interview, his cell phone rings. And he goes, excuse me, picks his cell phone, and he's on FaceTime, and he's clearly none of this. He doesn't care that I'm there as far as this regards, but it's his daughter. His daughter says something like, hey, Daddy, I just wanted you to know that so-and-so, I think it was a mother of a friend of hers, died. And she said, you know, I just want you to know that so-and-so's mom died. It's really sad. And Shaq goes to her. He goes, I will never forget this. He goes, listen, I'm paying for the funeral. Make sure they know they don't have to pay for a single thing. I'm taking care of all the expenses. Just make sure they know I'm paying for it all. Okay. All right, Daddy. Thanks. I love you. You're the best. Click. Bye. So what were we talking about? It was one of the nicest 3-second moments I've ever witnessed in my life.
What do we clear up in this book, Jeff?
I mean, I feel like I do kind of get to the root of the relationship. I think it is awkward. Obviously, the book was written all completely before Kobe Bryant's passing, so it's kind of awkward to talk about some of it. I do think the root of the Shaq-Kobe troubles kind of go on Kobe Bryant. I think he arrived for his first meeting, his first team meeting in 1996 in Hawaii. Everyone's gathered around. Del Harris is a coach. All right, everyone, let's just do quick introductions. All right. Hey, I'm Nick Van Exel from Cincinnati. Hey, I'm Eddie Jones. Yo, my name's Kobe Bryant, Lower Merion. Nobody here is going to punk me. Like, that was his sort of, hey, I'm Kobe Bryant. And players are, you know, guys are like, yeah, that did not go over well. And Shaq really wanted, through the years, this relationship. He wanted, you know, he talked about it, the Batman, Robin, the big brother, little brother. And Kobe didn't want that at all. Like, didn't want that at all. When Kobe got married to his wife, Vanessa, in Dana Point, zero teammates were invited. Most of the teammates didn't know the wedding was happening. Most of the teammates didn't know he was even dating someone. Throughout his career, veterans were brought in one after another. After, like, J.R. Reed told me a great story. J.R. Reed was acquired in the Glenn Rice trade from Charlotte. And Jerry West loved J.R. Reed. He said, I really love the way you work with young players. Can you help? Can you bring Kobe more into the team? J.R. Reed's like, I'm on it. I got it. They're on the plane. Yo, Kobe, why don't you come back here, play cards with us? Nah, I'm good. Yo, Kobe, we're all going out to eat. Five of us are going out to eat. Why don't you come with us? Nah, I'm good. Yo, Kobe, we're all going to a movie. You want to go see a movie? Nah, I'm good. He actually went back to Jerry West and said, there's nothing I can do here. And I just think that relationship truly was a guy, Shaquille O'Neal, who wanted a bond and wanted to be this guy to this other guy. And another guy, and it's not a criticism of him because it's just who he was. Kobe Bryant just didn't want that. Like, he had no need for it. He didn't see it as anything he required. When he was going through the sexual assault situation in 2003, he reports to training camp first day. He's late and he's surrounded by reporters and someone says, are you going to turn to your teammates for support during this time? And his actual response was, why would I do that? Like, he just was not a person who sought that or needed it. And it drove a real wedge, I think, between the two of them in many ways.
I remember being in Dallas and the Lakers were in town. They were going to play the Mavs. Right. And I think it was the night before, and Shaq, Rick Fox, a couple other players were out. Okay. And I approached Rick Fox and then I said, hey, where's Kobe? And he goes, and then he goes, Shaq, come here. And he goes, he wants to know where Kobe is. And Shaq goes, he don't come out. And then they started laughing like it was the craziest thing that I'd ever asked, that where's Kobe? And they said he stays in his room all the time.
Wait, I'll tell you two quickies. John Sally was with the Lakers for 1 year, Phil Jackson's first year. And he told me one night he got Kobe to come out in South Beach. And it was a huge win for John Sally, getting Kobe Bryant to come out in South Beach. And they're at a club. It's 10:30. John Sally is on top of the world because he got Kobe to come out. Kobe looks at his watch and he's like, yeah, man, I got to go. And John Sally's like, it's 10:30. What are you talking about? He's like, yeah, I got to work out at 5 tomorrow morning. I can't. I got to go. And then when I was with Shaq, one thing he said to me that I just thought was really kind of telling and interesting. I said to him, it was my last question I asked him. I was like, you know, you always gave yourself nicknames, but it was jovial. It was always with a wink, you know, it was always like Shaq Diesel and the big Aristotle, but it was never serious. It wasn't like he was really calling himself that. And I said, and Kobe nicknamed himself Black Mamba, but he seemed like he literally sort of viewed himself as the Black Mamba. Like, it was a thing to him. And Shaq he smiled and he goes, now you know what I was dealing with, bro.
He's Jeff Pearlman. The book is Three Ring Circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, The Crazy Years of the Laker Dynasty. I love the draft day story with the Nets and John Calipari. And I read it and I was cringing that here's Calipari trying to do something in New Jersey and he's got a chance to draft Kobe. Pick up the story from there.
Well, the Nets are going to do it. They have the 8th pick in the draft. John Nash is the general manager. John Calipari is the first year coach. And here's Kobe Bryant. And he's a regional star. That's the other thing. Lower Merion, not that far away from East Rutherford. So they have decided. They've worked out Kobe 4 or 5 times. They love him. The one thing they did, it's funny, they screwed up something. They had to fly Kobe from his workout in New Jersey to L.A. And they put him in a middle seat on a Delta flight for the flight. And his agents were not happy about that. But they love Kobe Bryant. And they work him out. And the day before the draft, they call Pam and Joe, Kobe's parents, and they say, how do you feel about us drafting your son? Because Kobe was only 17 at the time. So they actually had to say to the parents, parents like, yeah, it's great. We'd love that. He's close by. Right. So Kobe has a sneaker deal with Adidas worked out with Sonny Vaccaro that's done. And Adidas does not want Kobe Bryant playing East Rutherford for the friggin' Khalid Reed and Ed O'Bannon. They just don't want that. And Jerry and Art tell him, Kobe's agent, are close. And Jerry West works out Kobe Bryant twice. It's the two best workouts he's ever seen anyone give, ever. He decimated Dante Jones, and then he decimated Michael Cooper in back-to-back workouts. And he wants Kobe Bryant. So they kind of, everything is working behind the scenes here. He wants, they want Kobe, Adidas want Kobe. The day before the draft, Kobe calls John Calipari and says, yeah, coach, I've been thinking about it, and I don't want to, I don't really want to play near my parents. I don't want to be near my parents. I kind of want to get away. So I don't really want you guys to draft me. Well, Cal, he's like in his mid-30s. This is his first draft. You know, he's a little high energy. He goes to John Nash and he's like, oh my God, what are we going to do? This is, he doesn't want to play for us. And John Nash is like, calm down. It's all just a ploy. Don't worry about it. Well, then Kobe's agent calls John Calipari. He's like, listen, don't draft Kobe. If you draft Kobe, he's probably going to either play in Italy for the year or sit out. He's not going to play for you. Calipari to John Nash. Oh my God, what are we going to do? This is the worst thing ever. The best moment happens. Kerry Kittles of Villanova, All-American, good player, is represented by David Falk. David Falk calls John Calipari and says, you know, Cal, Kerry really wants to play for the Nets. He wants to stay regional. If you don't draft him, I cannot promise you that I will be having players, free agents go to the Nets. Calipari's like, holy crap, what the hell? Again, John, what are we going to do? Calm down. It's just a thing. So John Nash is convinced the night before the draft, it's okay. We're going to take Kobe Bryant. This is going to be a generational player for our franchise. The next day, Calipari holds a meeting. And the one thing in Cal's contract, he had final personnel say over his general manager. Mm. It was this meeting. John Nash is there. And he goes, all right, guys, here's what we're going to do. Kerry Kittles is on the board at number 8. We're going with Kerry Kittles. If not, we're taking Kobe Bryant. And John Nash is absolutely devastated. And as soon as the Nets announce, or David Stern announces, the Nets have selected Kerry Kittles, guard Villanova, Jerry West knows what the next 4 picks are. None of them have shown an interest in Kobe Bryant. And when they draft, when Charlotte picks Bryant and they make the swap for Vlade Divac, Jerry West goes into Jerry Buss's office and says, I just got you the best player in this draft.
Oh, poor Cal. Okay. Poor Cal. If I gave you one basketball question for Kobe, what would it have been?
Oh, man. I mean, the thing I'm fascinated with him truly is he arrived, and this is to his credit, 1,000,000%. He arrived knowing he was going to be the next Michael Jordan. Like, it wasn't a doubt for him. It was zero doubt. He arrived knowing he was better than Eddie Jones and should be starting. And he resented Del Harris for not letting him start. He arrived knowing there should be post. When Del Harris was a coach, Kobe goes to him as a rookie and says, coach, why don't you have more post-up plays for me down low? Del Harris's response is, because we have Shaquille O'Neal. Like, the confidence, the one thing I feel like I don't fully understand about Kobe Bryant, and I would love to, I wish I had the opportunity, was where does that level of self-assuredness and wherewithal, and like, he didn't care what his teammates thought about him, to his credit. He didn't care. Whatever they were saying about him, he didn't care. I think one of the things that bothered him about Shaq is Shaq was sort of sitting in judgment of him, and he actually didn't sit, he didn't care. Like, it was like off his shoulder, you know, he didn't care. And I wish I had that. I'm sure most people wish they had that. He had that ability where he was just deaf to it all. I'm here to play basketball. And I would love to understand that better than I do.
So it didn't bother him what people thought of him, but he would sit in judgment of others.
Well, I think what bothered him, there were things about, just as an example, there were things about Shaq that really bothered him. The free throw thing killed him, just killed him. I talked to Derek Harper, former Laker, longtime NBA guy, and I was like, about Shaq and free throws. And he was very blunt about it. He said, I will give you the secret to why Shaq wasn't good at free throws. And I was waiting for this big answer. And he goes, because he didn't work at it. He's like, he just didn't work at it. Like, he didn't work hard enough at it. That crap drove Kobe crazy. He did not understand how you could not hit 70% of your free throws and why you wouldn't work hard at it. So he definitely sat in judgment of Shaq with that. he definitely felt Shaq didn't work hard enough. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but he didn't feel he worked hard enough. So it was the basketball things that bothered him. But was it, you know, was he sitting in judgment that Shaq was off making, you know, mediocre movies or doing this or doing that? No. He just, how does this affect me?
Yeah.
And you not shooting free throws affects me directly.
Good luck with the book. Fascinating read. Well researched as always with you. And at times it was painful to read some of the things about Kobe. A three ring circus, Kobe, Shaq, Phil, and the crazy years of the Laker dynasty. Jeff, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
All right. Jeff Perlman. As Paulie points out, you know, that he wrote that book on Walter Payton, and it was brutally honest, I think, and Paulie had a problem reading about Walter Payton that way.
Not a problem with Jeff. He's doing his job, but it's, you know, your youth sports heroes, you could put on the blinders, I guess.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.